Welcome to the Bodice Rippers Romance Novel Podcast, a podcast where we take a deep dive into the world of romance novels, looking not only at the nitty-gritty and sometimes steamy parts of romance novels, but we like to also look at the many different aspects that bring this genre together. We like to look at the authors and looking at their strengths and weaknesses, looking at the process of the authors, and also looking at the historical aspects of romance novels. We're a bunch of nerds, but it's going to be a lot of fun, so get ready.
We're back. We are here to talk about a really awesome author that I didn't even know existed. So
you're welcome.
Thank you for seriously sending me her, because nothing makes my heart happier than finding a new author and then diving into multiple books. When you give me an author and there's only one, I'm like, wait, I need more.
Right. You're like, no, this was amazing. And it's a brand new like treat and a gift and all these things. And then you tease me with 400 pages and you're like, peace out. I got to go do like my real job, like be a librarian or whatever bullshit like authors do, you know, to actually survive until they make it.
Right.
But I wanted you to write a trilogy all in about 2 days. And then I could ingest all of it on my timeline. Thanks so much. I don't want to wait 3 years for your final book.
It's true. 1000%. I love that there's multiple books to read again. So I read the first one. So this is, by the way, we're talking about Evie Dunmore.
Evie Dunmore, would you please come on our podcast? Because my girl crush on you is quite large. Because A, you're adorable. And B, I love your writing. Okay, fangirl moment.
She is adorable. And I do like her Instagram. Well, you know, I would like to see more. I want to know, you know me, I've already said this. I want to know everything about all the things. I want to see how you write. I want to see your ideas. I want to see your weird FBI board with all the strings put together. As you're mapping this out, like, I want more, but what you give us is great. I'm super happy with it. I also will say this is one of them too, where the cover didn't really show me what to expect.
Right.
I would say like, I get it. Like after reading it, I can see it and I'm like, okay, but it does feel something like I would buy one of my teenagers for sure.
It's a little bit, yeah, it was sort of the red, white, royal blue kind of delivery of that aesthetic, right? Where you're like, okay, this is she's writing her fourth book in the series. So we're discussing the League of Extraordinary Women, right? And so all of them have very similar covers to this, where it's almost cartoonish in a way, like in terms of graphics, but you're also like, she's delivering stories that are rich in history. This is all about, you know, around the time in the UK where the women are trying to get the vote, the suffragette movement, all of that. And so like, there's actually a lot of detail in the history of women trying to, you know, gain equality, right? So it's like, she has sort of a serious premise at the same time that she's delivering these love stories, right? And these love interests. But then you have the cover where you're like, but what am I going to be reading? Because it doesn't quite match up, right?
Quite a matchup. Yeah, exactly. So when I got it, I was like, okay. So as I started reading, I was pleasantly surprised because it did feel a little bit like it was going to be more of one of those fun Christina Laurens, you know what I mean? A little bit more whimsical, dare I say, but yeah. I feel like you're right. It's a very rich story. I really liked it. And there is one thing to be said that I would say from this historical aspect is I'll be honest, I didn't know a lot about this women's suffragist movement, right? I didn't know a ton about it, but I do, as you read this, you really see how it was, number one, it was so against the current narrative in the realm of Great Britain, but you kind of forget, it's not just England, right? There's Wales, there's Scotland, there's Ireland, there's all these different like components of this one monarchy, this empire. This was during the time of Queen Victoria, which again, I love historical fiction because I'll go down a freaking rabbit hole, you know? Yeah. And so then the minute you mention Queen Victoria, I'm like, let me know all the things about this.
Would you wait a moment while I go put my corset and petticoat on myself and then I'll be right back.
Then I'll know all the things, but yeah, no. And I've watched a few of the, you know, there's a few different Victoria shows on PBS. You know, there's one where she's young, there's one when she's older. There's one with Emily Blunt, which I love. Like, I love Emily Blunt, so anything you put her in, great. But I love this, this time that we live in now, that we can read something and we can pull from those like movies or TV shows or even other books that are even fictional or nonfiction, that we can kind of paint a broader perspective and understanding. And yes, they are, of course, they have bias because the authors are writing from their perspective and point of view. But it is nice to see Queen Victoria painted in this like positive way on one show. And then it's not like there's a negative portrayal of her, but it is interesting that this monarch of the realm is so against women's rights. Like, right. That was a very interesting juxtaposition, is this woman who is running a country and probably has so much pushback from men in her everyday life, trying to handle this managing of this empire, that mm-hmm. you would even think to be against what these women were standing for.
Right. It doesn't quite make sense, because you think that, like, yeah, I mean, everyone in parliament is a man, right? That's the whole point. There's no female seats anywhere, kind of thing. But yeah, you have a female leader, and she's not really on the side of females, right? Like, she's not going to amend the Marriage Act and, you know, all this sort of thing. So it's interesting to see that portrayal of that thought throughout the series, right? Because I've read the next two, I'm eagerly waiting the fourth one, kind of thing. But it's also interesting to see how that, you know, I mean, that's the premise of what she's writing about, is she also has, at least in this first book, she has a real inequality of status, right? Between the female protagonist and the male protagonist. But in her sequential books, that's not actually true. There's actually some lopsidedness that happens, and there's some equal status that happens. And so it's great to see that theme run throughout, but the different sort of context for each book is different when you have women who actually have money, come from power, all that sort of stuff, and are fighting for that, or still might be like sold, quote unquote, off to a husband for, you know, a strategic or political gain kind of thing. Versus the ones, you know, I want to fall in love and all that sort of sense. And then the third book that, or the second book, I just reread the second book, actually. I can't spoil it for you, but there's a real interesting dynamic that happens, because once you get married, X, Y, and Z, you're no longer your own person, your property is gone, all that sort of stuff. And it's Lucy's the second book, and Lucy's kind of like, F you, man, fuck you, and I'm going to do it my own way, which is great. So I like how Evie, again, she's got the four main girl group, basically, that come together. So each story, you know, progresses per friend, but they're all just so incredibly different. But the mindset is, we have to fight this, whether this is through subterfuge or subtlety or outright, you know, protest. And Annabelle in this one, she, you know, she goes to jail and all that sort of stuff. So I like that interplay of, you're seeing a different perspective from each main female protagonist as the series progresses, but it's all with the same common goal, which is, we're seen as chattel, right? And there's not many advantages for us. Even if we're born into wealth, there's not that many advantages for us, right?
Right. So the fourth book, is it the Catriona?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I love that. Yeah, yeah. No, and it is, again, going back to Queen Victoria, it is interesting that the one woman that wasn't true for is the one that's against everyone else, every other woman in the realm, right? Like, right. It was not true that when Queen Victoria married Prince Albert, he did not become king of the realm. You know, nope. He was, what do they call that?
I don't know, suitor, or you're something weird. Like,
I don't know what you. Yeah, but you're not in charge, right? This woman, because of her line of birth, the line of succession, she gets to retain all of those exact things that all of these women are wanting. So it was an interesting play of like, that doesn't make any sense to me, like, make it make sense. But it is like, monarchy in general is just such a unique situation.
Are you pro or con?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because this was when the monarchy actually did something, right? Like, the monarchy now, so pro, like, great, do your thing. You want to be steeped in tradition? Amazing. But also, like, I'm not really committed one way or the other. Like, you want to get rid of it? Get rid of it. You want to not, you know, it's like, those things happen all over the world, and it's cultural. Like, even in India, there's still a caste system. There's still a class system. And like, I feel like now it's simple to look at that. Like, there's still people that move here that had arranged marriages, right? And yeah. I think in a culture as rich as India, as old as India, right? India is one of the oldest cultures ever, you know, that's existing still. It's easy for us to look at that culture and be like, so not for us, like, so not for me personally, not us. Like, I'm just saying, so I can see where it's like, that would never happen, that culture is so alien to me, but I understand that it's so ingrained in their day to day that it still makes sense over there, right? Like, I'm not going to sit here and say that it's wrong. Like, that is a complete culture that is on the opposite end of the world that is so just steeped in tradition that I have no place to say that it's right or wrong or not for anyone. It's just not for me, right? Like, that's just, it's so simple to do that for a place like India. But you talk about a place like Great Britain now, that shit still probably happens. I'm sure there's still people in the gentry that don't marry because of what could happen to their status and whatever. Like, I'm sure that still happens, but that seems a little bit less acceptable because it's like, I don't know, maybe it's closer to home, or it feels like a more modern place, quote unquote, or closer to our own culture. But we would look at someone who was in an arranged marriage that's in the gentry in England and be like, that's ridiculous. Like,
no, I think it's just so foreign to us, right? Because for the most part, although I know there's limitations for women in the United States too, and men for that matter, but like, that's just not something that's culturally has been around. I mean, we're toddlers on the world scale, right? Like, we just haven't been around for that long. But it, I'm sure it does still happen. And I know someone very personally who had an arranged marriage from India, and that did not work out, but it was in the thought of, you know, this is what was best according to the parents. And like, they knew that the bride's parents and all that sort of stuff. So it was really done with well intent, but also like, that's just thousands of years old of tradition that, you know, is hard to sort of break away from, especially if you're steeped in it for so long and you believe it. So it's not, yeah, it's not good or bad. It's just sort of what is. And I mean, even places like, I think Japan, one of their princesses of the ruling family, she just gave away her entire title line, everything, because she married a commoner. And that's strictly said in, you know, the legislation of that, you know, empire, that you can't, and you forego the title and the right and all that. And she was like, well, I love him. And so like, that's, there was no question for me. So it is still very common modern day, you know, things that are happening. I think it's just, it's odd for us when, for the most part, here we're like, well, we pretty much get to choose, right? And so it's, well, like, it's just an odd thing to sort of comprehend.
Exactly. And even looking at the whole marriage in the British monarchy with Prince Harry and whatever her name is, Meghan something, whatever her name is, that chick,
Meghan Markle. I don't know what the hell you're doing, but could you not stop? You know, whatever it is,
whatever. Meghan Markle. Yes, like. Of course, to us, it was so glamorous, right? Like, the whole country, stuff that they were doing, thought it was so amazing, so progressive. But I am guaranteed there were people in England that were pissed. You know what I mean? I think we all know that. I think they're still pissed because they moved, or I don't know. I don't follow the drama clearly. But like, to us, we look at that and be like, ridiculous. That's, it's 2021, whatever year we are in. I don't even know what year we're in. But yeah, we can look at that now and be like, of course he married Meghan Markle. Like, why, how could you ever be like opposed to something like that? Hello. But there's people that totally are. And that's not for us to say what's right or wrong.
Let's talk about the fact that polygamy is still up and running, and sister wives is a real thing. And people are, I mean, so it's like, we have some weird ass shit here too. And, you know, cousins that are first cousins getting married and then their babies are mutating. So, I mean, at the end of the day, there's some weird ass shit. But thank you, Evie Dunmore, to bring us all the way back. Appreciate the fact that you know, and she seems like a big nerd. If you do her deep dive in her biography, she went to Oxford.
Her first post is like two cats. So she's already a cat lady.
I actually did appreciate, because recently she has talked pretty candidly, like, she's not on Instagram a lot, but she's talked pretty candidly about the struggle of writing, right? So she said in one of her more recent posts about like, hey, like, this is hard. Like, it's been a hard 2 years. Like, it's been for everybody. She's writing the fourth book in the series. And so she's like, you know, I'm not going to be here very much. And I see a lot of writers do this, which of course you have to, right? I don't think there's any way you can be a full-time writer and be a full-time Instagrammer and like have that creative energy going in both directions all the time. Like, Liz Gilbert does this too.
Which is why you should hire us. Hi.
Hi. We do have things for you. Okay, great. And we'll make your website super pretty. But Liz Gilbert does this too. She's blackout on Instagram when she's writing a book, which you should be, right? But Evie really did talk about, you know, like, it's been a struggle. It's been hard. Like, this is taking me a little bit longer. This is slower. And I just so appreciate that honesty, because you and I have always talked about this, how people on social media, you see, we had a podcaster who's talking, maybe you and Leah talked about this. You always see their 17th chapter, right? And you never see 1 through 16. So it's like, here's my beautiful published book. I already have an agent. I already have the book deal. I have a book deal for 3 more, kind of thing. And you don't see the fact that, like, yeah, she has a book deal, but she's still struggling, you know, and she still like has to go out into the highlands of Scotland to like finish this book. So I did really appreciate that from her, with that kind of like candor and honesty, because sometimes you just don't get that, right?
Yeah. And see, I'm the opposite. I'm like, I want to see every chapter. Show me -2. Like, I want to know the impetus of this book. Like, I want to see the whole enchilada. And people don't
want
to show it.
You want the 24/7 stream is what you want.
Full stream. Yeah. Show me. I literally want to watch you stick post-it notes on your wall and tear them down. like,
but you also, you know what else I appreciate is the people who are, and I feel this is much more true for authors than obviously celebrities or actors and how they're found or whatever, but authors who just literally come from nowhere, right? Like right. You had no golden, you know, silver spoon. You had no famous aunt or uncle. You had, you know, like all this, your, you know, person wasn't, Scorsese wasn't your uncle. Like, I love the fact that like Evie Dunmore seems like a very normal, I mean, ish, she's got cats on her Instagram, so whatever, but like a very normal person, because she like, okay, she did go to Oxford, so she's got brains evidently, you know, but like, she seems like you or I, and it gives you that hope, because that is anyone who's aspiring to be a writer. It's like, yeah, a lot of it may be luck. A lot of it, I think a lot of it's actually just sitting down and writing the actual book is really intimidating. And I think that's when most people stop, right? Like everybody wants to write a book. Right. I've written two now, which there you go. There's my shout out. But like the most intimidating part is neither one have gone anywhere. Let's just be clear. But like, I love the fact that I've written two, but like it's sitting down at your computer, which is a very lonely job,
right,
and motivating yourself to do it. So it's like, I think a lot of times making it as an author is a lot of luck. And it's a lot of like just that chance meeting with that person that you have, but it's also that people don't, 98% of us don't actually get to the point of writing. Right. So I love her story and her, I don't know all of it, but like a lot of these people that we're reading are like you and I, very normal, very like started out just sort of saying, hey, I have a thought and I want to get it out there. And it's like, yes, thank you. Like for that, because that's not the normal trajectory, I think, for a lot of people who are in the limelight, right?
Right, right. Well, and the idea of like being a professional writer is so odd. Like you don't have a set schedule. You have to be like the epitome of self-motivated, the epitome of self-governing. Like you're getting these publishers, that are potentially, and I mean, sometimes they're not. Sometimes you're just writing a book and spraying and praying, but sometimes you do get this advance from a publishing house and they're just pretty much letting you do your thing and praying for the best, you know, to come out. That is really difficult. Like me personally, I feel like I've got so many books inside of me. I've not sat down to write one. So I'm not an author. Like I could not call myself a writer because I don't write. I've got so many rich stories in my brain, but they're not going anywhere. So, because I don't have the space. Like I could, if this was a priority, I would set aside time and do it. It's not that I don't have time. Nobody has the time to write a book. That's ridiculous. Every single person that's a writer finds the time.
Right.
Like, makes it a priority and sits down and do it. But yeah, I mean, when I do, like, I'm going to do that experiment of like, here's day one of this idea. Like, cause I want that, you know what I mean? So I feel like it's an experiment that I'm willing to try of like, I'll write a book just to show the process and see if people are interested. Because I want to see that from the opposite side. So yeah, I mean, kudos to her. She's obviously getting a good head start with this rich story of these four friends, which I do appreciate how different they are and how she can kind of spin this whole idea of, because at the end of the day, romance novels are a girl usually meets a guy, unless we're reading a LGBTQ book. There's a conflict. There's a reason they can't be together. And then they end up together. That's generally the idea of every single book we read.
Right.
Right. But like, it's so great to be able to see somebody paint that picture, even within a constrained time, even with a constrained format and an overarching theme of this suffragist movement, and have it be rich and different and varied. So that's gotta be a hard job.
Well, and no, it does have to be a hard job, but I'd like to comment on that, because I think the fact of the matter is, this is why we read romance novels. Like, no, we already know what the end's going to be. At least if you're doing your job correctly, because if you don't put them together at the end, I never want to read you again. Cause like, what the fuck is this point kind of thing.
Said to me.
But this is also why you watch Hallmark movies. Like, you understand there is a formula and it's going to be delivered perfectly. And off you go into the light and joy of all your happy times together. If you don't do that and one of them dies of cancer, you will be done. Like, I will not revisit, you know, that is not what I'm here for. If I want to sob, I will go read something else, you know, kind of thing.
And full disclosure.
But it's totally true.
Full disclosure, I don't watch Hallmark movies, you do. And you and Nina do. So I'm gonna actually,
you're so tragically missing out on some of the sappiest, worst stories ever told and the worst acting, but at the same time, you feel like you just had a big chocolate chip cookie and a massage and you're like, life is so good.
Well, now I need both of those things in my life, a chocolate chip cookie and a massage. And I am going to give it a whirl because apparently Hallmark started already. So I need to go in and watch them But yeah, I feel like these books are so similar to that, right? It's that feel of like, you know, it's going to work out. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest. I did have a little like sliver of doubt in this one that it was going to end up the way it was going to end up, but it did, you know, and it was great. I freaking loved it. I thought it was really well written. I will say my one complaint is that there was like one sex situation. I wouldn't say sex scene because there was multiple sex experiences within that one scene, but that was it. I was like, you gave us one.
Yeah. And that is something of a common theme throughout where, and I don't know. She's, you know, she's the UK, a little bit more uptight, if you will. Maybe, you know, we're American. We're known for being really slutty and sleazy and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So maybe it's just, yeah, but I had that complaint too, because she writes great sex scenes. She really does. But yeah, you get like one, and then you get a lot of intrigue with like the hand laid on the chest and he was too close in my space for appropriate, you know, cultural, you know, norms or whatever. And that's true kind of throughout the next two that I read as well. And it's like, oh, or she does the thing that we talked about, which we both loathe, where it's like, start them off in a sex scene and then it's like, and then they, you know, ... and then they were like naked lying on top of each other at the best orgasms of their life. And it's like, dude, but you missed the whole like detail.
I need the orgasms. I need all of it. I need everything detailed out. Yeah. And so I, like you said, I feel like the sex scene was great. Like the one she wrote, I was like all here for it. But then I was like, that's all?
Yeah.
Like, and then you cut to them on a honeymoon. This bullshit. Like,
yeah.
I need more. Like, give me more of this. And also same thing, her sexual tension. Great. She writes it really well. It's awesome. But like, I need the payoff more than just one.
No, I'm right there with you. I had the same struggle because she writes them well. And it's like, I don't need them every chapter, but I need a little bit more. And that could be just the historical storyline of, you know, in this one with Montgomery as the Duke and Annabelle as the female, very poor, you know, student kind of thing. There's not those opportunities, you know, and she rejects him multiple times and all of that. But I was like, oh, you could have thrown in like three or four more, because I am a huge fan. There are historical romances out there written by authors where they are having a lot more sex and they're having good sex. They're having like sex where you're shoved up against the library wall and, you know, people can walk in at any moment. And it's like, yes, like, and we talked about this, I think, in one of the last episodes too, where it was like, a lot of these authors do a really good job of applying modern sex, what we consider modern, so to speak, to that time, right? Which I love, which I think it's brilliant.
Because I wish we did have a time machine to go back. It's like, did people even do that? Like, that's what I think about Bridgerton every single time I watch it, because I've watched it multiple times, obviously. I'm like, was this even a thing? Like, there is a whole scene in Bridgerton where they're having sex outside in an atrium where all their servants could watch. I'm like, was that a thing? I mean, I know it could have been, because that is like servants, they didn't care about servants, but like, I have a hard time believing that like you can't even walk in a garden by yourself with somebody, but you can, when you're married, just completely be butt ass naked in your estate and not give a shit about anyone walking up, including servants and including any neighbors. Like, I don't buy it.
I don't buy it either. And there was a scene in the atrium, but there's also those scene that like is the picture of every like, you know, thing that you see anywhere of them in the friggin' front lawn in the yard. And he's like butt naked too. And she's, you know, I'm like, that must be an extreme freedom that we, as the, you know, the Protestants that we grew up as.
I don't do that. Like, I've never had sex in my front yard because I'll get arrested.
Most of America doesn't do that because we are a little prudish at the end of the day, you know, as well. Yeah. The only time I have physically actually seen sex outside was when I lived in college. I lived for a year in Spain, and culturally in Spain, you, when you're dating someone, you actually, at least this is how it was the house I was in and my friends, like you don't move out of the home basically until you're married. So like my host sister was probably like pushing 30 and she was dating a guy, but like you don't really move out until like the marriage happens, but you also don't have your significant others over. Like you don't have a boyfriend or girlfriend that just comes and hangs out like in the house. So all of your activities have to take place outside the home. So I can't tell you how many people I would see having like sex in the park under a bush at night, because I used to go on night runs. And it was like, okay, that's going to be uncomfortable in the morning. Or like sex on motorbikes. That was a popular thing to do. So like there is a lack of inhibition that in other countries about sex and nudity that is not the same as it is here, right?
Make that make sense to me. You can't have someone spend the night in your home, but you can have sex outside where any stranger can walk in on you. Like, that does not make sense. That's exactly what I mean with Bridgerton. It's like, it doesn't make sense that you can't be seen in a different room together, but when you're married, you finally can be, like, you know what I mean? It's just a mismatch for me. Like, which, whatever, I guess it's fine. But yeah, that was my big takeaway, really, to bring it back, is I wish there was more sex scenes. And I, again, I've only read the first book and it was really good. So for you, favorite character, and because I mean, we know at least the protagonists, the women that are in these books, we were introduced to all of them in this first book. So based on that, I feel like I could guess with the next books who my favorite characters are anyway. You know what I mean? Other than like their love interests. So for you, right, who was your favorite character?
You know, it's interesting. In the first book, I don't actually know if I had one, because I kind of had issues with like Montgomery and Annabelle as the leads. I mean, I liked them, but I struggled to love them a little bit. Whereas I enjoyed Lucy and Hattie and Catriona, right? Mm-hmm. A lot. But now that I've read the second book, which is about Lucy and her story, she now has colored my opinion, and she's my favorite character, I think, out of the first one, because I loved her story so much in the second one. Mm. So I liked her, and you know, she is the figurehead of this suffragette movement, like for the entire kind of UK, and they have different chapters, obviously, you know, depending on where people live. So she's in a really prominent public role, and kind of comes across as really harsh, you know, in the first book. You know, she's not super like lovable in that sense, but when you hear her story in the second one, you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense, I get it. And now I can really appreciate, there's one line in the second book, I'm sure I won't even tell you because I'm sure you'll know it, but like when she says it, it's like, oh damn, there it is. Like, that was like the pinnacle of her story, you know, in that moment. So I think she's my favorite one. I do like all the boys because the boys can just be the boys too, right? And they're like, I'm gonna be you know, a prick, but then I'm gonna be really kind. And I like the jovial nature of them, where the girls have to be a little bit more restrained, right? So there is a little bit of that tug of war, I think. How about you though?
Yeah. Well, again, I've only read the first one, and all the women, same thing. It's like, I like them all. They're all likable, you know, but it's not like any of them really stood out. I feel like for me, reading the first book, I did like Montgomery's character, actually. Sebastian is his real name, which is very coincidental because it's the same name as Bridgerton, the Duke in the Bridgerton movies or books. But I actually liked watching that transition, especially the political change, because that would have been like, I know this is a book, but like to have somebody that's in that position go toe to toe with the Queen of England, who is trying to get you to do what she wants, which is a more conservative, you know, view, a more traditional view of what England was, and then to go into Parliament and make a statement and completely leave his party for not just a woman, because I mean, of course there is that like element to it, but just because on principle, like you believe in something. That was a very interesting transition to watch someone that seems so like stern and in it, set in his ways, and have that transition over like some realizations that happened in his personal life. Now, is that very believable? I don't know. I haven't met a lot of people in Parliament, so I couldn't tell you, but I could say as like another human to human, when you see something that completely shifts your paradigm, and you meet someone even in your mid-30s, even though you are, you know, acquainted with your life and you're comfortable where you are and you've lived this life, you're obviously the same life you've lived with this culture of being in the gentry, meeting someone that's not in your class and having them have such an impact on you to change and shift your paradigm, that's huge. And I feel like that's super inspiring. So I did love his character in the book.
I mean, he basically just commits full out political suicide, right? 100%. Like, that's what he does. But it doesn't, and I don't know how realistic it is. It doesn't kill him, right? Like, he's still, and they carry his and Annabelle's story a little bit more into the second book, which I appreciated. And then by the third book, they're pretty well, like, not as prominent, you know, kind of, they're still there. They're also friends and all of that. But like, they, you do see some of the slight repercussions that he has to sort of endure because of that choice he made at the end of the book, and, you know, even coming back into quote unquote polite society, basically. But yeah, I mean, and well, frankly, you just don't see many people commit political suicide ever for their beliefs.
I did love that part too, where like he was so set, like he had this idea of restoring his family name. He has his father who lost the ducal seat, this like palace basically, in a card game because he was a gambler, drank himself to death. So he was so focused on trying to like get his family name back to where it had used, you know, had been. And to him, his most important thing was getting that palace back. And he finally like realized, like, I don't need that. You know, that's one more property that I don't need. And right. It's like, I feel like I've seen transitions like that are not, of course, that big or whatever, but you've seen that in people where they're so focused on one goal. And then like all of a sudden they realize that that one goal that they've dedicated their whole lives to really doesn't matter. It's like a very interesting thing to see someone shift. So that mm-hmm. was very visceral, I feel like, in her writing, which I liked.
Yeah. No, and I saw her just briefly on an Instagram live kind of interview a couple weeks ago, and she was just the cutest thing ever. So I feel very confident that she would want to come on our podcast and talk to us, because she needs to tell us about all the things. Well, and also like, she is actually living, you know, if you look on her website, she is a consultant. It says, you know, in kind of what she calls her civilian life, you know, has this degree from Oxford. I'm sure she, and this is what you see. It's, I think it'd be really interesting to see when that transition happens, right, too, with authors, because you have people, Liz Gilbert, you know, J.K. Rowling doesn't really write anymore, but you know, she was, who have really achieved full-time author status. That is what they do full-time. Versus someone who, Evie is still very successful, USA, you know, kind of today best-selling author, all of that, but like is still working. So like, it'd be really interesting to see those two differences in those worlds of like, do you actually want to make the transition to a full-time author? Or is it like, this is just, you like doing both. You still like having, you know, a foot in the real world. That's where some of your inspiration comes from, or whatever it may be. Because I feel like, as you said, like that writing process is so challenging and so difficult. Some people may not want it to be their full-time everything, but like, I know a lot of authors who are librarians, you know, for on at the same time. So it's like, I like this, but I also get to do this, and their whole world, you know, are books, which is awesome. But it'd be cool to see those two different conversations of people who are like, no, I want it. It's my dream. It's all I've ever wanted to do. Or people who are like, no, actually I'm really good still being kind of normal and connected to the world, you know?
Yeah, especially if you're writing any kind of like historical thing, you probably could get immersed, and it's a little bit, I don't know that you would want that to be your whole life, is like research and digging in. Yeah, for sure. I would love to have her on the podcast so I can demand more sex. Thanks.
And that's your takeaway, kids. After you've listened to this entire episode of us talk about Evie Dunmore, whom we love, we actually need more sex, which is so funny because we actually, on this podcast, we actually don't talk about sex that much. We just give, you know, a nice little rating, and then we say if we need more or not, you know. So what would you
talk about it if we need to? But
I mean, we can
talk about it more if people want it. So you're gonna have to tell us what you want, audience, when this actually launches.
Right. So then, from the one sex scene she gave you, what would you rate?
Oh yeah. I would give it like, I would say, I'd give it between a 7 and an 8, 7.5 and an 8. I felt like there was a good variety to move from oral to regular sex, missionary position to doggy style. I will say that was put in within a more pleasant, polite terms. So you know what? A solid 8.5. I'm going to give it an 8.5. That was good.
Yes, I'm probably around there. Again, my view's colored because I've read the other books, and she does have a little bit more in the coming books, and she's, especially by the third one, there's quite a bit, which is very, very enjoyable. This first one, I'd probably put it right at a 7 because I really, like, I wanted just more content, because sometimes like you have to find that balance too, right? Because there's some romance authors where I'm like, oh my God, it's like a sex scene every other page. And like, could you give me a little bit of a storyline, just something,
any story.
And then you have, you know, people like Evie who are like, okay, there's one and now I've read 7 chapters and I'm waiting for the next one. So I'm actually speeding up to see
I'm literally just skimming to go to the next sex
scene. So I'm missing the storyline now. I think if, yes, yeah. So it's like, you have to find, please us, and find that balance. That would be great. Yeah,
1000%. It all like comes to fruition over one night, which I will also kind of comment on. Like, these people are having these like in-depth, like soul conversations in between them having sex. Like, I don't know about you, but I don't have these deep soul bearing conversations in the middle or after having sex. I don't know. Maybe I'm doing it wrong, guys. Am I supposed to be doing that? Because no one told me I should be doing that.
I mean, I think it's however you want to do it. I mean, Eric and I have something which we call the relationship gym, and then we spend time in the relationship gym. So that's all kinds of, you know, intimacy, but it's actually a lot of conversation too. So we do talk, but like, we've been together 11 years. So I don't know how, like, we don't talk about like, yeah, every time is not like soul bearing. We talk about our lives a lot. That's true. But like soul bearing, like these guys are doing, and the succession in which it happens, which is like great sex, great orgasm. Everyone's tired, sleeps for an hour, soul conversation, another round of sex, soul conversation, another. I'm like, dude, you have been going for 12 hours. Like,
I would have had two migraines. Like literally I could never hang in that situation.
Oh, that's some stamina, and you know they're not eating a lot because they got to fit into their dresses with corsets.
Like, I would need a sub sandwich and and a cookie and a massage, like you said, I'm going to do tonight. Yeah, so all of that seems outside the realm of my sexual experiences, but hell, maybe I'm doing it wrong. I'm going to need you to unpack that relationship, Jim, in a later episode because I'm fascinated by that. Okay, perfect. So we have the same ratings. We talked about our favorite characters. Now, are we only talking about what we're reading now? Is that what we're doing?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. What we're reading now.
Okay. So what I just finished, actually, I had to look it up because I forgot the name of it, but I just finished reading by Rosalind Miles, Guinevere, Queen of the Summer Country. Have you ever heard of it?
No. Was it wonderful?
It was actually really good. So I was looking for The Mists of Avalon because my therapist had suggested like finding that. It's a classic and I haven't read it. I've heard of it. So I put it on my my holds in my Libby app, but this one came up and I was like, I'm going to give that a whirl. Seems like a good read. So it's based on the Arthurian legend, obviously like King Arthur, Sword and Stone, Guinevere, Lancelot, that whole shebang. I loved it actually. I thought it was really, really fascinating. Because they really looked at it very culturally, like this is a legend, right? There's no proof that this person ever existed. They think that King Arthur was based on some, you know, early British ruler, but there's no real proof. It's a legend, right? But they looked at this story of Guinevere as coming from this like tribe in Britain, in England, somewhere in England, I think in Wales, actually. Is where it was really based on, but they were focused on a matriarchy. So they had a ruling queen in their country and that was passed down woman to woman, daughter to daughter. And just the whole paradigm of having like a female like leadership and culture, it was very interesting. It was like something I don't think I've ever read about like an actual country and how it works, like because in your mind, like they even talk about it in here, it's like every queen needs a set of knights to guard her because she'll be overtaken and overthrown by a man just because of the sheer like brute force of a man. So you need to have this instilled in how they develop those relationships for having those knights be committed to her was super interesting. It was done through obviously plenty of ritual. They had a lot of ritual based off of the like pagan holidays. They talked about the one in spring, where every spring they would light these big bonfires, and then women, no matter if they were married or if it was the queen, even anybody, all these women were supposed to go out on these big bonfires and at night like find a random stranger and have sex with them because it was supposed to be like the coming of the sun god from the winter. You know, it was like super interesting, but that was like part of their culture, right? And so like these married men would like have these wives, have amazing marriages, whatever. And like one night it was just this religious cultural phenomenon. And I was like, that is fascinating. And of course, more of it than just like the sex part was fascinating. But I really enjoyed that perspective of like a matriarchal society and how that would work.
Hmm. Sounds like a very adult book. Is this an adult book? Does this take me some effort to read?
No, I mean, it is very, it's like a story, you know, it's not like a fucking Bible, but like it's good.
And you just pissed off happy other faux listeners that we have.
Well, whatever. But it's not like, yeah, that's to say the Bible's hard to read. I'm just going to say it out loud. As is Lord of the Rings. So it's not just the Bible. There's plenty of books that are hard to get through. Dickens. There. Like it's hard to read Dickens. you know, so it's definitely not a hard read. It's super good. I would totally recommend it. Guinevere,
what's it called again?
Guinevere, Queen of the Summer Country.
Queen of the Summer Country. Okay, yes, I will read that. I'll have to look into that. Okay, so while you were reading more advanced things, I went back to my YA roots. And have you ever read, it's a duology called, the first one is Crown Duel, and the second one is Court Duel. Your kids would actually probably really like this. So by Sherwood Smith, and it's just a really fun story. The main female protagonist, it's set in an imaginary country, long time ago kind of thing. But basically there's a king who's kind of ruling everything and is pretty terrible. There's some hard scenes to kind of read, but there's this countess and her brother, the count, basically sort of start this rebellion in this country to save sacred land, basically these trees that are super sacred and these tree people that live there. And it's basically, the first one is all of her journey, like through the country, evading people who are hunting her. She starts kind of this revolution, this rebellion kind of thing. And then there's one potential male adversary who is the male protagonist, you know, throughout. And then she follows it up with her sequel, which is now she's at court after sort of this big thing happened at the end of the first book. And now she's at court and now she has a whole different game to play, right? Versus like the first one, she's out in the countryside romping through, trying to just survive and you know, not really rally people to the cause, but like try to stop this sort of like terrible king who's in charge. And the second one is like, now she's in court and having to deal with duplicity and people who don't like her, and a very different kind of game is played. It's really enjoyable, super fast reads. Like you could read both of them in a night. That's but honestly, like, yeah, they're so good. And they, you have to tell me what you think, because they're literally like, they're just enjoyable. And I have read them probably every year since I was like 13. Like they're really? Just,
yeah, they're that good that you read them every year.
Love them so much. And they're just so easy to read. They're comfort books. You know, those books that you're just like, yes. I mean, you have it. You have that with Aaron Morgenstern or Morgan, right? And Every time you're just like, oh, I know it's coming, but I still get excited to read it. And then I read it all in one setting. And then I have to read it again. It just makes, again, massage, chocolate chip cookie, all the things happen right then.
I'm literally making a batch of cookies when I get off. Quit talking about it.
Sorry. So good. It's the holidays. Oh my God. It's the holidays. It's so many treats are happening right now.
The holiday season. Yeah. I can't wait. Perfect. So next week, what are we talking about?
Next week, we're talking about Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo.
Yay. Oh, I love it. Oh, that one's so good. I'm so excited. And we should actually talk about her breadth of work, because there's a lot of good ones. Taylor Jenkins Reid. I love, love, love.
Right. Well, she came out with Daisy Jones and the Six and or whatever all that was. So that was a big splash that happened.
That was one of my favorites, Daisy Jones and the Six. And then her latest book was Malibu Rising that I just finished probably 3 weeks ago. Excellent. Also excellent. So yeah, mm-hmm. we will focus on Daisy Jones. Evelyn Hugo. Have you read Daisy Jones?
I haven't read Daisy Jones, no. And I am in the middle now of Evelyn Hugo. So, and I'm really enjoying that too. So I'll be all prepped for next week. And we're doing double episodes next week. So going to be 9 and 10. And then we're wrapping up season one.
What's the next one we have to do? I forget.
It's Jennifer Armentrout.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Good at that one. Okay. Yep. We got a lot of reading to do. It's going to be good.
Yeah. All right, awesome. Guys.
Okay. See you guys next episode. Bye.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Bodice Rippers Romance Novel Podcast. We are just so completely delighted that you guys are tuning in and listening to all things romance novel related, as well as all things in a completely different tangent. We're here for big conversations, small conversations that are on topic and off topic. Please, 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 if you have a second, just rate, review, subscribe, leave us a note, leave us a message. It just really helps us in the podcasting world, as we pretty much want to be doing this full time because we just love chatting about all things romance novels and talking with all of you guys. So if you have a quick second, let us know how we're doing. And of course, if you have any feedback, just pop us a review and let us know what we could do better, could do worse, or could do more in a hilarious fashion. And until next time, you guys, get out there, read those romance novels, and let us know what are your juiciest takeaways. Talk to you soon.